This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
This is the 1A Record Club.
The 1A Record Club. This is 1A.
1A.
1A Record Club.
Hey! Let's go!
Welcome to the 1A Record Club.
In case you forgot about her for a minute, she's back.
And you're not Dylan Thomas. I'm not Patti Smith. This ain't the Chelsea Hotel. We're two idiots. Who's gonna... Long-suffering propriety is what they want from me. They don't know how you've haunted me so stunningly. I choose you and me religiously.
Taylor Swift delivered her latest album, The Tortured Poets Department, on Friday. And like she did with her previous album, Midnights, she posted a surprise for fans a few hours later. 15 extra tracks to the album, bringing the total track listing to 31 songs, a double album. No matter what you think of her music, there's no doubt that Swift is prolific. She's released 4 albums since 2020, plus another 4 re-recorded albums. Her Eras Tour sold out mega stadiums across the U.S. and around the globe, and the tour continues through the rest of this year. The hold Taylor Swift has on much of the popular consciousness defies comparison with most other current artists. Here she is talking to the New York Times in 2019 about her writing process.
It's like this little glittery cloud floats in front of your face and you grab it at the right time. And then you revert back to what you know about the structure of a song in order to fill in the gaps.
Today, the 1A Record Club convenes to ask where Swift's newest album fits into her catalog of music. And later, we look at what the Taylor Swift phenomenon tells us about the idea of an American monoculture. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Stay with us. We've got a lot to get into.
This message comes from Capital One, presenting sponsor of the 2024 Tiny Desk Contest. Earlier this year, unsigned musicians from around the country submitted their original songs for the 10th annual Tiny Desk Contest. The panel of judges are hard at work picking standout entries, and you can follow along and choose your favorite videos as well. The winner gets to play their very own Tiny Desk concert, then headline a tour with NPR Music this summer. Want to come along for the ride? Visit tinydeskcontest.npr.org to learn more, then check out the Venture X card from presenting sponsor Capital One. Earn unlimited 2x miles on everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Joining us now from New York is Maria Sherman. She's the music writer for the Associated Press and author of the book Larger Than Life, a history of boy bands from NKOTB to BTS. Maria, welcome back.
Hi, it's me. I'm the problem, it's me. No, I'm kidding. Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us from Los Angeles is Bilal Qureshi, an essayist and longtime contributor to NPR. Bilal, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. And I don't have my line yet, so I'm thinking about finding that signature. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we're also hearing your thoughts on the album. One of you texted, "I think the album is a success. The lyrics speak to me even as an adult, long past my 30s. Well, we wanted your thoughts if you've been listening to the Tortured Poets Department. Email us at 1a@wamu.org. There's a lot to get to with this album in a lot of different ways, but I just want your overall reactions to it. Maria, I'll start with you.
Sure. In listening to this album, it was sort of interesting because there was no framework in which to know where Taylor was going with this, Was it going to be a continuation of Midnight's? Was it going to appeal to the people who prefer her folklore and evermore sort of attempts at Americana and folk music? And it turns out it's a little bit of everything. And I think that kind of speaks to an artist who has spent the last couple of years performing her entire body of work on the Eras Tour. And the result is a very personal album and one that really does pull from her discography across the years.
Bilal, what about for you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I actually found it a really beautiful and moving record, and one that was sort of surprising given the Eras Tour, and that there could be a temptation, I assume, to go even bigger and to bring something even more industrial. And I thought that the fact that she has clearly found a very specific adult sound at this stage in her career, that it seemed to just be a continuation of it in a way that only, I think, evolves and grows in some of the writing, I do think is really quite incredible and sort of different than some of the earlier stuff she's done. I mean, I guess it's so hard, and we're going to get into this, is that, like, it comes with so much other noise and so many other people's opinions. And I think that the fatigue that people are feeling toward her was also kind of, accompanying this record. So I think for me, the goal was to try to listen to it this weekend without some of that, turning off some of the discourse that sort of inevitably surrounds her now. And I found the record itself as an album a very satisfying and moving record.
Well, let's hear a bit from the song, "But Daddy, I Love Him."
Growing up at all, he was chaos, he was revelry. Bedroom eyes like a remedy. Soon enough, the elders had convened. Down at the city hall.
Now, Maria, you said there wasn't a real framework around this album, but did you hear certain themes emerging again?
Certainly, and I love this song. It's actually one of my favorites, even though I've noticed in the sort of online discourse, people are writing it off as maybe one of the more biting tracks. And in my mind, I was just so happy to hear echoes of Country Taylor a little bit. There's a little bit of a return to a sort of fairy tale songwriting. It's a moment that isn't sort of written in the first person, or at least interpreted as being in the first person in some moments. And so some of those lyrical lines, revelry, remedy, the saboteurs are protesting too much. It's very fantastical, and that's a sort of frame of Taylor Swift I really like. You know, she always says this thing that she writes with either a glitter pen, a fountain pen, or a quill pen, and I feel like this is a little moment of that quill pen, which I find to be really captivating and sort of beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know Swift's fans have come to expect her to write about heartbreak and past relationships. Bilal, what were some of the themes you hear in this album?
I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is that the kind of early Taylor Swift of the, like, 2010s, the reputation kind of, you know, mode in which she was sort of seen as a bit of a, you know, she has vengeance in her song. She kind of, you know, names names and kind of takes, you know, I think takes stock of things. I found a lot of the writing to be also very self-reflective and very, a little bit more, a lot of these relationships and things that have fallen apart, blaming herself, her own anxieties and insecurities, which seemed, you know, more present to me in the writing here than I've heard in some of her earlier stuff, which can feel a bit more like, yeah, like a bit more swagger than there was maybe here. And I also thought exactly what you were saying about the kind of country and Americana sound of it. And she's also perfected this kind of very insulated, almost cinematic, enveloping sound with her two kind of producers and partners. And Ann Powers, who's the great music critic for NPR, described this album as novelistic and cinematic. And I also found that kind of feeling that once you start it, it is a bit like the sepia-toned film, which was also the kind of cover, is this kind of cream, black and white kind of color palette, that it has a very specific auteurist kind of frame. And it sounds like that too, like very complete in that way. And I did think it was a little less like sort of glitter and sashaying on the stage as she does in some of the serpentine sections of the Eras Tour, and a little bit more, like self-reflective and adult, as somebody I think who gets into their mid to late 30s starts to become.
We got this text from Debbie in New Orleans who says, "I listened and I loved Clara Bow. I'm not a Swiftie, but I'm impressed with her talent and her woman-centered life." Here's a clip from that song, Clara Bow. And Bow was a silent film actress and one of the first major movie stars in the 1920s.
Be happy.
first personified the idea of an It girl. She starred in a film in 1927 called It. And she started acting at 16, so she was a contemporary of stars like Joan Crawford. But pressures from the press and studio executives led her to retire from acting at age 28. Maria, what maybe comparisons or connections do you hear Taylor Swift making to her own life and place in pop culture in this song?
Clara Bow certainly enters a pantheon of great final track songs on a Taylor Swift album, and it certainly kind of highlights her understanding of her place in popular culture. It's certainly self-reflective. She's seeing maybe Clara Bow as a metaphor, perhaps a cautionary tale. I do think on this album, it's appropriate to think of Taylor Swift as kind of tracking in autofiction, and I think this is a great example of her doing that, and then also naming herself. So she's kind of singing, the line is, "You look like Taylor Swift in this light. We're loving it. You've got the edge she never did." She's a little bit distancing herself from her, from herself, and allowing that to kind of speak of her public perception. It's sort of self-deprecating. It's one of those moments where she's the sort of sword is pointed towards her, as opposed to sort of looking outward for some of these struggles that she's facing on this album. It's a real tortured poet moment, I think, of the album. And of course, she also mentioned Stevie Nicks on the song, and Stevie Nicks wrote a poem that begins the album. There is a real theatricality here. I love the comparison to a novel, because I think that really tracks on the tortured poets department. And I've just sort of been reminded that 2 years ago, Taylor Swift said that they announced that Taylor Swift will be making her directorial debut in a screenplay she wrote. If we see some tortured poets in that screenplay, I wouldn't be shocked. There is really something about that full body of work.
Taylor Swift announced this album's release date while accepting the Album of the Year award at the Grammys in February. Maria, your thoughts about the timing of this new release?
Yeah, that felt a little shocking, if only because, one, she's using the Grammys as her own platform, and maybe she's one of the only pop stars who would be able to get away with doing something like that. Of course, the other would be Beyoncé, but there's a tumultuous relationship between her maybe not getting recognized for her talents by the Recording Academy on that stage. But the other element of it is she gave us a good 2 or 3 months to prepare for this album release, but didn't drop a single like she might have in the past. So it only kind of further grew anticipation. And I think for the last couple of years, certainly the last 2 years, perhaps a lot longer, she's done a really expert job of continuing to provide her audience and maybe just the general pop culture curious audience with information about her, anticipation, new music. As you said, she's had an incredibly prolific career, and certainly the last couple of years in releasing albums. So there was definitely something to the fact that she was keeping everybody engaged. And, you know, there's only been a couple weeks, it feels like, in the last 2 years where I haven't been talking about Taylor Swift, and I do wonder if everybody else feels that way, and I do wonder if it eventually will hit some sort of fatigue or exhaustion.
Coming up, Swift's Eras Tour continues into its second year. Cultural adaptations like Dune and Barbie have become blockbuster movies, and the Sphere in Las Vegas captures our curiosity, to say the least. We discuss whether the U.S. is returning to a monoculture, or if our post-pandemic culture is a more complicated story. Back with more in a moment.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
Let's get back to our latest installment of the 1A Record Club. Well, Taylor Swift is currently on pause from her Eras Tour, and it picks up again next month through the end of the year. The tour has so far topped $1 billion in gross ticket sales, and both of you attended an Eras Tour concert. This is an experience many people have shared, but not everyone. But Bilal, how did attending that concert make you think about Taylor Swift's control of this cultural moment?
Yeah, I mean, I was really interested because I think that I would describe myself probably not as her, premier, like prime sort of demographic, perhaps. And I found that the fact that it was this massive event, I live in Los Angeles, where she did six nights back to back at SoFi Stadium, one of which became that film version of the tour. And it was just like almost seemed the only thing that anyone was talking about. And so it did seem like the curiosity factor was what drove me to want to attend. I think the lock, as you were saying, that she has on her audience, the kind of intimacy she creates in a stadium, absolutely. But I do think the fatigue is not just coming. I think it's already here. I think a lot of the mixed reviews that people, some of the mixed reviews that the album is getting has less to do with the music and the fact that some of us have really enjoyed it and find it beautiful and poetic, but that there is this kind of monopoly or Swiftopoly that we're in all the time. And it seems that, you know, we go from the album to the Eras Tour to the film version to more. And going back to what I think critics and people who cover pop culture end up doing, it's like the only thing it seems that you can talk about that will also get an audience's attention and interest. And I think the concern with that kind of thing is just, when this tour was happening, it's like a lot of other live acts are struggling. A lot of other venues are not having, you know, the opportunities that they've had as well. And I think people have a limited, you know, live music or entertainment budget, and it's also very expensive to go to. So I think, you know, definitely I think some of that fatigue is here. And I just wonder about a lot of the people who can't, you know, obviously compete at all when you're operating at this industrial scale and at that volume, because there's so much of this content out there. I think to people who are imitating, I mean, there's a lot of other pop stars who've released albums back to back, it seems, the last few weeks with tours that are announced that are not doing as well in terms of ticket sales. So clearly the market can't absorb everyone's Eras Tour. I think that is something that does feel like a tension that we're facing with her and her particular kind of brand.
Well, that makes me wonder, and Bilal, I know this is something you've thought about. When we talk about this idea of monoculture, first, how would you define it?
Well, you know, there was a great piece in 2019 that I would direct everyone to read. It was written by Kyle Chaika, who's a critic, about the monoculture for Vox. And he was describing it as sort of, you know, when, yeah, there is this shared collective culture that we can all, as a water cooler moment, refer to and dissect and disagree about, but that we can all connect on. And I think that in the broadcast era and in the old kind of even pop music radio era, we all had those kinds of stars. And that because of the streaming age and the digital age and the atomization of all of us and our niche interests, that it sort of disappeared. And I do think it came roaring back after COVID, especially with, I think, Eras, Renaissance, Barbie, Barbenheimer, all of that. I think it was all actually, I think, planned and strategically thought through, that people do need something big and communal afterward. These are strategic thinkers who produce these things. And so I think that definitely roared back last year. I am curious if it continues this year, if we still, you know, feel that way, because I think some of the divisions are emerging again. I think Cowboy Carter also sort of had, I think it received good reviews, of course, but I don't think it's had the same effect that Renaissance has had in terms of when it was released and into the culture. But yeah, I don't know. I think that that's the idea of the monoculture, and that we in America, being as different as we are, find these common threads sometimes to really link up on. And Taylor has been that kind of figure for several years now.
Maria, I'd like to hear your thoughts, especially in a post-pandemic time. Do you think we are approaching something that at least could look like monoculture?
Yeah, I think it's complicated, and I agree with what Bilal was saying. I think if there are, if we're seeing the way that at least the music industry functions, that's what I'll speak to, because that's sort of my expertise, become sort of thinner, and there are fewer channels in which to find success. And I'm speaking of economic success. That means that people who are floating to the top get a sort of larger share of whatever is happening. So part of this, I think, is simply like, if we see what is resembling a monoculture in music, it's because those are the ones who have the sort of resources for it. I do think the pandemic is absolutely the correct framework to think about this from, because in the years previous, we were thinking, well, algorithmic fracturing is sort of individualizing everybody's interest or access to certain art or entertainment. We have this horrific event. Perhaps it's now a time to share a moment organically, and maybe that feels a little schmaltzy, but I think there's some truth to that. However, I think it might be quite limiting. It sort of reminds me of this argument we have in music journalism around this idea of poptimism. Are we supposed to take pop culture and popular music history seriously? Is it sort of an exercise in nostalgia? I'm not sure. There are all these additional complications. I will say, though, that when we're talking about music specifically, the fact that we are talking about Taylor Swift and Beyoncé is very interesting to me because they are artists who reach certain apexes before the pandemic and certainly before streaming. And I think they kind of benefit from that. You know, the fact that we're talking about Taylor Swift in 2024 is quite fascinating to me because I thought in 2014, when she released 1989, that was the sort of ultimate symbol of her power. And how wrong was I? But, you know, who could have predicted a pandemic and these impulses to sort of share in these water cooler moments as we were talking about?
We got this message from Jay in Oklahoma who says, I remember the day when most of our culture was through the radio and MTV, and most people knew or at least heard most of the same artists. Since the rise of social media, it seems like the only artists people know are the megastars like Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish, and Beyoncé. The rest of the artists are obscure with small followings. This is far more democratic, but it seems like there's no middle ground. I mean, Bilal, when you look at, especially in music, that the landscape of artists we have right now, is there a middle ground, or is it that you're either a megastar or you've got your following that you've built on Twitter and those are your people?
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right. And I also think the idea of like taste making and you know, I mean, I think that people who report on the music industry and the business side of it could speak to this much more. But I think artist development, you know, really investing in people's careers over a long period of time. I think now if you have an album or a song that comes out, if it hits, that's great. But if not, I think you can be, you know, moved on from very quickly. And I think that there isn't a kind of development that used to happen of people to become part of the middle and then eventually hopefully bigger. The other thing is I think that I felt like last year part of the reason for this monoculture was also that most of these tours, these events were generally on a feel-good front. They didn't have a lot of, frankly, provocations or politics in them, which also I think makes it easier to connect. I mean, to some extent, I think some of the critics of Swift feel like she can be a bit inoffensive and kind of, you know, forgettable in some ways, and that there have been questions, like she doesn't say anything about politics. But and I would say that, not that I think that should happen in pop music or music always, but I do think that they were kind of safe and secure big tent events. And I think with something like Cowboy Carter, which is a provocation to the country music industry and to certain elements of American music, less of that big tent feeling exists. So I think the other thing is that the monoculture also benefits from sometimes a kind of apolitical feeling that these particular events had, that I feel like will be harder this year, given that we're in an election year, there's wars, there's protests. There's a very different mood to me, it seems, larger in our culture than there was in 2023 in the summer of the Eras Tour and glitter and partying and Barbie and pink.
I think there's an argument to be made that Renaissance, Beyoncé's Renaissance, actually was political in the way that she platformed and centered LGBTQ performers in the concert and in the music. So while Renaissance was exuberant, right, it was very party oriented. You just wanted to dance. There were political overtones there, Bilal.
There were, but I think that the spirit of it, which I think is also an incredible part of queer culture, as someone who is queer, is the idea of inclusion, and I think of kind of a really warm, inviting space that she created through this prism, and I think through the music itself. But I think the point of like Beyoncé having an American flag behind her as a country singer is in our country and in the kind of politics of it, a more provocative even image for some people, I would say. And I was back home. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, where I listened to country radio. And unfortunately, you know, the songs from it were not playing on my local radio station. And I think that some of that division exists in our genres and stuff. And I think what was amazing about these works that we've been talking about is that they did kind of cross over to lots of people, and they were designed to be that way. Taking fully into account what you said, absolutely, about Renaissance as an incredible celebration of queer dance and particularly Black culture.
I want to zoom out a little bit because I want to hear from both of you that in this moment, what market forces do you see having the biggest effect on cultural output today? Maria, I'll come to you first, and I know you think mostly about music.
Certainly. It's an interesting question. And it's a little bit hard for me to talk about pop culture more broadly, but specifically with music. I think also what we're seeing, I'm going to bring it back to Taylor for a moment here, because Beyonce, we would need another hour, I think. With Taylor Swift, when I listened to this album and you know, I sort of had to rush a review like so many critics now and then spent some more time with it, it really feels like an album to me that was written sort of for her fans. She is very good and has been very good at this for many, many years at sort of fueling the flames of the parasocial relationship she's established with her audience. And I think that is very indicative of what success can look like for a pop star. There needs to be that sense of accessibility or familiarity. And given the fact that all of her songwriting comes from a very deeply personal place, I think kind of reinforces that idea. And I think that maybe speaks to the way in which pop culture functions. I'll also point out that there isn't like an overwhelming pop like bop or banger on this album, which is particularly interesting. I mean, maybe I could do it with a Broken Heart. We'll have its moment on radio this summer. But I think that too is sort of interesting, because you would think typically in the before times, you would need a big pop song to perform well on radio, to sort of be everywhere all at once, to really have that kind of moment. And maybe that's speaking more of the way in which the business has changed in a sort of superficial way. But I do find that very interesting, that it seems like maybe we're all the Marvel Cinematic Universe and everything has to be specific to the diehard fans to have access to sort of live inside.
Bilal, your thoughts, especially when we look at pop culture more broadly, what market forces do you think are driving what we end up consuming?
Yeah, I mean, what strikes me is that as someone who came into like loving pop culture through the movies, which were the big medium of, you know, my youth and I think for a lot of people, I think then we had the streaming age and TV seemed to be like the main focus of a lot of criticism and writing. It does seem like the return of concerts and pop music, not that it has never always been big, but it seems like the preeminent thing. I mean, even eras and renaissance were films and there were movie theater experiences. They're like a kind of big... They include all of the things in the state of like when Hollywood is in the middle of a strike. I mean, when the Eras Tour happened here, you know, we were in the middle of a kind of very difficult contraction that's happening here in the film and television industry. So I do think the larger market force question is that you need stars and to build kind of cross platforms for them. I think about somebody like Zendaya, who is like not only a kind of fashion icon, but a movie star. And whether that's the kind of future is a sort of, you know, we're going to return to sort of old-time MGM-style stars. Whether they're a Taylor Swift leading a sort of circus-like tour around the world or a movie star that reminds us of an old-school movie star. Again, leaving questions about new stars and new voices.
That's Bilal Qureshi. He's an essayist, critic, and longtime contributor to NPR. And Maria Sherman, she's the music writer for the Associated Press and author of the book Larger Than Life, A History of Boy Bands from NKOTB to BTS. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Michael Falero, and this program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Let's talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.